My name is Dick Hilden, and the title of this session is Voices Within Mexico. What I'd like to be essentially tonight is a messenger. That is, I'd like to carry the words of some people living in poverty and hunger and oppression in Mexico. I'd like to carry their words to you tonight. As a result of a study trip that my wife and I were on a year ago in Cuernavaca, Mexico, we had the opportunity to meet with a number of people who live in that place and to a great extent are involved in the struggles and pains of the poverty situation which exists there. I wish they were here tonight. I think of Angela, who could tell her story so much better than I do. I have a slide of her, you'll see her. I think of Gabriel, who could tell his story so much better also. But I will try to be a messenger for them tonight. Before I do that, however, I'd like to give you just a little bit of background about myself so that you have a feeling for the context within which I'll be being the messenger tonight. I am a professional electrical engineer. I have been involved in corporate management over the past several years. And fairly recently started an engineering company in Minneapolis. I also am the chairperson of the Center for Global Service and Education, which is associated with Augsburg College. The role of the Center for Global Service and Education is to raise awareness of people with regard to justice issues in third world countries, and more specifically to countries in Latin America, and even more specific than that, we have been concentrating on countries in Central America and Mexico. But our general role is to raise awareness with regard to third world justice issues. We have some, we do that through, incidentally, trips, which are study trips to those places. We do it through conferences and that sort of thing. One of the reasons I mention this is that the Center for Global Service is one of the places in the United States that we can use as a resource for finding out what is happening in these places. There are other very good resources. Holden Village has just a remarkably good library. It's a good resource center and bookstore for getting resources relative to these places, the third world countries and other places where injustices are taking place. I don't think when it's asked of us as human beings and Christians, where were you, Christian, when the suffering took place, that we can respond that we didn't know. We in this country have the opportunity to know. And so I would offer the center as one possibility for that resource. I do have some newsletters that the Center for Global Service puts out. I have some copies. If you'd like to look at that and take one of those with you, you're welcome to do that. I also have some brochures which describe some of the trips and some of the seminars that the center does handle, and you may want to look at those. I would ask that if you do, that you leave those here, in that I only have just a few of those which are sort of typical of the brochures that we're using. And furthermore, and lastly, as a housekeeping item, so to speak, I do have a list on which you can sign if you'd wish to be on the mailing list of the center. So, in fact, I think I'll pass that around. If you'd like to get on the mailing list, receive the newsletters and other materials, that would be an opportunity to do so. The study session that my wife and I attended in Mexico took place in Cuernavaca, which is just probably 50 or 60 miles southwest of Mexico City. It's sort of between Mexico City and Acapulco. Cuernavaca is a location which has, on one hand, some very high wealthy situations, and on the other hand, some rather stark poverty. It is a good place to see this contrast, and it is a good place to be in touch with some of the suffering that is taking place in Mexico. Just a word about the session format. I'm going to be using a 35-millimeter presentation here to give you a chance to essentially meet the people that we talked with, to see them in their background, and therefore I hope it will add something and enhance the communication between them and us here. If you have questions during this presentation or comments, please raise them. It's highly likely that many of you have been there and can contribute to what is being said here, and I would welcome those kind of supportive kind of comments. So if you have had similar experiences and wish to
I've been in Mexico.
Good. Well, if you well, if you can identify something that where your statement would make a contribution, do it. Well, be sure to raise questions or comments if you can. Let's proceed. Incidentally, I'm going to be using a mix of notes that I have, also a script that has been prepared for this slide presentation, but which I'm doctoring up considerably. So I may seem to be kind of disjointed. I hope you'll bear with me as I bounce back and forth between notes and this other thing I have here. I'll try to make it not too obtrusive. I'd like to give you a very broad brush of the Mexican situation. I'd like to lead you through the history in a very, very rapid pass so that you have some feeling for the development of the culture there. You may recall, probably do, that in the year about 1521, Mexico was conquered by Spain. A statistic. At that time in the Mexican area, there were 30 million Mexican Indians, indigenous Mexicans. By the year 1600, only 80 years later, there were only 1 million of those left, 1 million of the 30 million. So you can understand that the indigenous population was essentially decimated. Much of the Indian crafts and culture were decimated at the same time. And it was also only through some restoration efforts at a later time that some of those things were gathered again through oral tradition that took place. So it was a devastating and traumatic thing for the indigenous population in Mexico at that point or in that location. During the period from 1521 to 1821 approximately, a period of 300 years, the Mexico existed as a Spanish colony. And then in 1821, Mexico received its independence, along with a large number of other Latin American countries. It almost moved as a wave throughout Latin America, such that most of them received independence about in the early 19th century. The period from 1821 till about 1910 was a period in which Mexico was independent, but was highly controlled. It was controlled economically by a relatively small number of very wealthy and elite families, and it was also controlled by the church. And I guess we would identify that perhaps as spiritual control. So the control of the people during that period was the church and a relatively small few rich. During this period, the political tone of the country was very unstable. The average lifetime of a government in that time was 9 months. So you can imagine the turmoil that took place. During this period, with regard to the economy was such that raw materials were shipped from Mexico to Europe, and finished goods then were shipped back, sort of a mercantile economy. Another point that I'd like to throw in here is that in 1848, the United States essentially took one half of Mexico, annexed one half of it. Texas, a good deal of New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, California, and I think even some of Utah. Maybe some historians here could help me on that. But essentially, half of Mexico was annexed by the United States in 1848. Then in 1910, the Mexican Revolution took place, a revolution which was based on a seeking for land reformation. Another very costly revolution. In 1910, there were 15 million people in Mexico. By the time, by 1920, there were 13 million people. So you can see the revolution was very costly in terms of lives. Millions of lives were lost in it. Okay, then taking another jump to 1934, Cardenas became the president of Mexico. During 1920 through 1934, through that period, there was various turmoil. I might say also I think a point of interest is that in that early period following the revolution, there was legislation for labor that was very, very progressive, even in terms of today's labor legislation. Very progressive, but it just couldn't work because the country simply wasn't developed enough. It's an interesting situation that the labor legislation was there. If it could have been implemented on a base of a wealthy economy, it would have worked, the type of economy that we experience in this country. But it didn't then, and it did not work. But anyway, jumping to 1934, Cardenas was the president. He was quite a socially minded president. He implemented land reformation. One half of the land was distributed to peasants. He nationalized the oil companies and nationalized the railways. So he was quite what we would identify as socialistic in his government. And the United States, incidentally, essentially gave Mexico the green light to do that. FDR essentially said to Mexico, proceed as you want, and in fact supported through a good neighbor policy what took place in those years. It wasn't until about the mid-1940s that Mexico started, under President Alemán, started a policy of developing Mexico through foreign investment. So in the mid-40s, Mexico started then to invite foreign investment, principally that of the United States, for the purpose of developing its economy. And that has taken place from that time until today. Just a word about the current situation, economic situation. As you undoubtedly are aware, Mexico has an exceedingly large foreign debt, in the neighborhood of $80 billion, plus or minus a few billion dollars. That is just very, very large. It's very difficult to service, and you may be aware that Mexico came very close to defaulting on a good portion of that. Apparently now the economic situation, at least from the financier's viewpoint, is that Mexico's in pretty good shape with regard to being able to service that debt. At least it's not going to default seriously. So that's the picture now. Mexico has, however, a highly devalued peso. I don't know what it is now. I think it
150.
And not too long ago, perhaps a little over a year, maybe 18 months to two years ago, it was down around 25.
Years ago, it was 40.
It was 40. Okay, in any event, there has been a drastic devaluation of the peso over the past 2 years. And also another condition in the economy at this point is that, and I don't know the specific data relating to this, but I can say with great assurance that the investment people, that is the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and other foreign banks which have large investments in Mexico, are undoubtedly placing very severe restrictions on that country with regard to its economy. These investment sources undoubtedly are placing strong controls on that economy, and that is felt by the Mexican people, and unfortunately, it's probably felt to a great extent by the poor people of Mexico, which represents a large portion of that. With regard to this current devaluation, a couple of causes for it. And these numbers are from a year ago, but I presume they're fairly accurate. Maybe someone can help me with this. At least they'll give you a feel for the ballpark of what is happening. Rich Mexicans in Mexico have invested heavily in real estate in the United States. Something like $20 billion had been, a year ago, removed from Mexico for such investments, representing a very strong feeling of lack of confidence in the peso itself. When the rich Mexicans did that foreign investment, they also placed $10 billion in dollar accounts. That is, accounts which did not fluctuate as the peso did, but held steady and retained their value at the dollar rates. So $30 billion, the number I received about a year ago, is how much capital essentially was removed from that country for productivity. Another cause of the devaluation has been the heavy investment by the government in Mexican oil. And as you're well aware, the price of oil has held steady and even dropped during the mid-70s and out to the present. And this has been a very heavy burden on the Mexican government. It has planned on higher oil prices, hasn't received them, and it finds itself in dire straits as a result of that. So economically, Mexico is in relatively tough shape. $80 billion is a very high foreign debt for a company like that. Okay, that's enough of the broad brush of history and the current situation. Now I would like to get on to some of the voices that we hear from Mexico. I'm going to have to turn this projector on. I would like to just very briefly show you just a few spots, locations, geographic locations of what I'll be talking about. Mexico City is about here. Cuernavaca is about here, and Acapulco is here. I'll be talking about some border industries, which are industries existing along the northern border of Mexico, the common border with the United States. So just a few points of orientation there. We talked last night about the fact that the perspectives are considerably different south of the Rio Grande than they are north of it. And it's important, I think, for us to as I mentioned last night, also to identify some of the differences in those perspectives. We had conversations there with people who have lived 20, maybe 30 years in Mexico. This woman's name is, and I'm going to do some balancing here now, this woman is May Brooks. She is a journalist who has lived for 30 years in Mexico. She explained that with regard to multinational corporations in Mexico, that there are 130 of them, primarily in food processing. Can you see over me, sort of? I'm going to read this anyway. So if you can't see this very well, I will read it for you. That 80% of these multinationals are based in the United States. I asked her what the return on investment was for these multinationals doing business in Mexico, and she estimated that the return was 75% to 80%. She also stated that foreign ownership of businesses is limited by law to less than 50%. That is, a foreign investor cannot control more than 49% or more than 50% of the business. This, however, is greatly abused through partnerships and lending of Mexican names. Now, the way that process takes place is that a foreign corporation will identify someone in Mexico, pay them a ton of dollars, and say, lend us your name as a partial owner of this, thereby maintaining control and yet staying within some sort of compliance with this law, but certainly in violation, in abuse of the spirit of the law. I want to give you a list of some of the companies doing business in Mexico, some of the multinationals, so that you'll get a feel for the kind of businesses that are being done there by the very large companies. American Motors, AT&T, DuPont, Anaconda, Anderson Clayton, Purina Ralston, Del Monte, General Foods, Bayer, Upjohn, John Deere, Dow Chemical, Niagara Chemical, Nestle. Incidentally, when I come to Nestle, I want to tell you I'm not giving you a boycott list of multinationals here. I'm simply giving you a list of those companies that are doing some business there so that you will have a feel for the kind that is done. Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Procter & Gamble, Nabisco, Quaker Oats, Kellogg's, and Kraft. Going to this point about the 75 to 80% return. I'm sorry?
You didn't mention oil
companies. I didn't, but they're undoubtedly there. Yeah, I'm sure that the large ones are. I suspect that this list was more oriented toward the food industry and the chemical companies, but certainly the oil companies are there because of the rich Mexican oil. Just a word about the 75 to 80% return on investment. That's exceedingly high. In fact, one could almost say on ethical grounds that's ludicrous. And I guess I would question whether it is 75 to 80%, and I would say that it is likely and possible that that kind of return on investment could be made by these companies for the following reasons. The companies are highly subsidized by the Mexican government, typically. Typically, they have tax-free operation there, or at least very, very low taxes. Frequently, the utilities are either subsidized totally or in part. Frequently, transportation for these companies is provided for the transport of the products. And there are other types of subsidies of these forms, which clearly reduce the cost of the production of the products that they produce there. On top of that is the very low-cost labor that is had in Mexico. And putting this all together, one could say, with some reasonable assurance, that 75 to 80% return on investments are possible there. And so I think the numbers are probably valid. She spoke quite convincingly to us. She has a considerable authority, I think. She talked about the border industries in Mexico. The industries along the border that I pointed out on the map can be 100% controlled by American companies. They supply, she told us, 80% of the United States winter fruits and vegetables, and that if that food were used to feed the hungry Mexican people, that malnutrition could greatly be stemmed. And I'll give you some numbers of how bad it is there. She talked about the laborers in these border industries. She said that they are typically young women between the ages of 16 and 25, and that they're very low paid, and that as they attempt to organize, they are crushed. That is, as they attempt to organize the laborers, they are put down and soon find themselves not employed and out of those jobs. That's why they are so young. A few population statistics. There are approximately 65 million people in Mexico. 35% of the population is involved in agriculture. Considerably higher, as you can see, than the United States. What is it in the United States? Probably 4 or 5% of our population, something like that, due to the high mechanization of our agricultural industry. 50% of the population are un or underemployed in Mexico. And underemployed there means, in our terminology, unemployed. It means selling apples on the street or something like that. Uh, 14 million peasants are landless. 25 million Mexicans cannot get milk. 14 million eat no meat, not because they don't want to, but because they can't get access to it. 4 million Mexicans are farm workers. The next sequence of slides shows a farm family. An average farm worker earns less than $3 a day for a 12-hour day. That's less than our minimum wage for an hour in this country, $3 a day. This child is playing by a tortilla oven, and as is typical of Mexicans, her main diet is tortillas. May Brooks told us that many Mexicans live on a very survival diet of tortillas, chili peppers, and some beans. On an average, more than 1,000 Mexican children die directly or indirectly from malnutrition daily. 1,000. If you work the numbers, you will realize that that on an average, during the time of this session tonight, 40 Mexican-American children will die of malnutrition. 40. We visited a rural village of Cuautitlán. It's an agricultural community. They had been suffering from a considerable lack of rain, so they had a prayer vigil where the entire village, or practically the entire village, went out to the fields and had a long procession back to the parish that evening, where they then returned to their parish for a worship service. May Brooks told us that the migration to the cities from the rural areas is very, very great, that there are 2,000 people And this number is wrong. 2,000 rural Mexican people are migrating to Mexico City alone per day. So you can imagine what it is to all of the urban areas within Mexico. Persons migrating to the urban areas are desperate. Their hope is for work. And unfortunately, it is tough to come by even in the cities. Neighborhoods or barrios of rural people are forming in the large cities. There is one barrio or very poor neighborhood in Mexico City that has 2 million people in it, more than the number of people in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area. 2 million people in one neighborhood. We visited one of these neighborhoods in Cuernavaca. Patio de la Estacion. It was a squatter's village that was set up in an abandoned railroad station. I'd like to show you a few pictures of that. We visited a woman that lives here. It's on a railroad siding. This is the main entrance to this. And it houses, this barrio has something like 5 to 10, Joan, can you help me? 5 to 10,000 people, I think, in this barrio. This is the entrance. That's part of a sewage ditch you see there. This is one of the yards. You can see the pig in the yard and the utter just poverty of that situation.
Can you explain how the barrio is?
Barrio is a neighborhood, essentially. It translates as neighborhood. We visited the woman that lives in this house. Her name is Angela. It has dirt floors, as do 50% of the dwellings in Mexico. She lives here with 7 children. She has given birth to 12 children. 3 of them, her first 3, were assisted. She had the assistance of a midwife. The last 9, she delivered by herself in this room. By herself, if you can imagine. Her husband returns from time to time, as is typical in Mexico. And while I'm on this point, I would like to jump to describe for you the situation of women in Mexico, the plight of the woman. We heard a young woman by the name of Irene Ortez. She described for us the situation of women in Mexico. And I'd just like to run through this very quickly for you. The normal condition is that men live with a woman and leave, and return and leave. That's the normal condition. The economic support of that family is left to the woman. There is sexist education in the home. I didn't say sex education, I said there is sexist education in the home. Children from a very early age learn their roles. It's very unusual to find a man that will wash dishes or make a bed. A woman's total expectation is filling that role. We ask Irene, is it possible for a woman to be liberated within that culture? And she said that if a woman tries to live a life, a liberated life in the terms that we know it, the environment and the context in which she finds herself culturally is so foreign that it is literally impossible for her to do it. Or at least nearly impossible to do it. She simply is like a fish out of water. The context simply doesn't support it. Girls marry very young. The superiority of the male is strongly ingrained. Sex education, and there I did say sex education, is limited, and there are many accidental teenage pregnancies. She estimates that 40% of women that become pregnant have abortions. Children are considered to be part of the woman. Women hope for a man to sustain her and her family for rest. But she also pointed out, and she hastened to do that, some families do work out. And she didn't give us numbers, but she did what I've just described, she pointed out, is the normal condition in Mexico. Notice the pans here to catch water dripping from this corrugated roof. Angela's house is one of the better ones in this barrio by a long shot. She has a relatively nice place here. The house is constructed so that much of it is open to the outside. It's clear that this does not keep bad weather out very, very well. Angela does earn some money by selling decorated napkins. We bought some of those. We estimate that she does those for something like 25 to 50 cents an hour. The barrio has used this as a schoolhouse, and they have recently replaced it with this one. We asked Angela what her greatest hope was, and she responded that her greatest hope was found in some sort of education for her children. She hoped desperately that that would be the case. That's where her hope lied. These are the toilet facilities for 150 families. These are the bathing facilities for those families. The ditch you see running along the bottom is the sewage facility for that barrio. That ditch runs right in front of, directly in front of Angela's house. Three water faucets are shared by 150 families. Angela told us that 3 years ago there was one water faucet and for 150 families, and that it was on from 12 midnight till 5 in the morning. So a great deal of their time was spent during the middle of the night waiting in line for water. And this is Angela. Incredible as it may seem, it certainly was to us. We found her to be a woman of considerable strength and serenity, and we were very, very warmed by this woman. It was an incredible thing for us. My wife Joan and I talk about the fact that oftentimes as we live our lives today, subsequent to our meeting with Angela, we see her face as we make decisions about how our lifestyle is to be. And for us, it was a terribly warm experience with this woman. We love her very much. This is Gerardo Thiessen. He is a coordinator of base Christian communities in Cuernavaca. Last night we talked about some of the basis of the base Christian communities. Just a quick pass on that. Base Christian communities have sort of attended the liberation theology movement that has taken place in Latin America, whereby small groups get together for Bible study and for analysis of their situation. To the extent they are oppressed, to the extent they don't have water, to the extent they don't have other facilities, these base Christian communities are starting to deal with those issues. Over and against Latin America, say 20 years ago and prior to that, when the Christian influence was more of a you shall find salvation in God's kingdom, God's heavenly kingdom, but your lot here on earth is fairly well set, albeit oppressive. That has changed considerably. Gerardo has worked on in-based Christian communities throughout much of his a life of service. He left Holland as a missionary to Latin America. He told us, "I thought that I was prepared to evangelize when I left Holland. After being in Latin America, I realized that I was not prepared. They evangelized me, and my perception of evangelism has changed." Gerardo told many accounts of persons in Latin America who have suffered severe persecution, and in many cases death for working for the cause of the poor. He told us love always has political implications. Love always has political implications. And while I'm on this point, I wish tonight again to recommend to you this book, Cry of the People by Penny Lerneau. It's an excellent book. It covers the struggle for human rights in Latin America. It particularly deals with the role of the Catholic Church in that place. And that role has been significant. And I recommend this to you very strongly. In fact, I've written the name of it on the top of the board here. I think it is available in the bookstore here at Holden, and certainly in the library. We were due to leave for Nicaragua the next day. He told us, be open to the faith of the poor, North Americans. Be open to the faith of the poor. Your faith will be strengthened in Nicaragua. The U.S. Christian, and I'm quoting him, the U.S. Christian has the possibility of being with and being inspired by the poor. This is Adela. Adela Jimenez has helped to establish several base Christian communities in her area. Adela was very actively involved in her parish church, but found herself continually frustrated by some of the traditions traditional practices within that institution. The priest did not encourage, in fact, to a great extent, discouraged reading of the Bible by parishioners. Adela developed a very deep desire to do it. She purchased a Bible from her neighbor on an installment plan. I can't remember how long she paid for it, but several months to pay for that Bible. And she said that reading it was like eating good warm bread. That's how she described it. She loved it. She became very involved in starting base Christian communities. She told us that a significant objective of the base Christian community is to raise awareness of oppressive conditions among those who are oppressed. She told us our community did not have running water. Following the formation of the group, it started to speak out and did get water. And other things were improved. They lost their fear to speak. However, the priest did not speak much about these small groups because the rich stopped giving. She told us, the people are like a sleeping community. They don't speak to each other. They didn't realize their poor conditions of leaking roofs or poor water. They did not realize that they are in chains. Christ said, I came to free. Her quote, Christ said, I came to free. This is Gabriel Munros, who I referred to before. He organized people who were employed in U.S.-owned textile factories. One of the factories he worked in was owned by Burlington. As a means for informing the workers regarding their labor rights, he published articles which included those labor laws pertaining to such exploitation. Gabriel was especially disturbed by the exploitation of young children in the factories where he worked. His children worked with him in the factories, as a matter of fact. Because he attempted to organize the workers in response to this exploitation, he was placed in prison and finally lost his job. He was essentially moved out of that industry and had to find work doing something else. He now runs a small store in the place where he lives. Foreign-owned plants such as this one do, as receive considerable benefits, as I mentioned before: tax-free operation, discounts on utilities, and free transportation. This, therefore, increases business profits, of course, for this company. It also comes at the expense of the Mexican government and, therefore, the Mexican people. It is felt by the Mexican people. In the heart of all this, we found this cathedral. This is the Cathedral of Cuernavaca. I would like to point out to you that this cathedral, unlike many cathedrals in Mexico, is quite barren. It doesn't have much glitter. It doesn't have much within it. It's quite run down due to the fact that it doesn't get much financial support. This man who, up until I think this spring, I think he is retired now, but was the Bishop of Cuernavaca. He has taken on the burden of the poor. He is known throughout Latin America for doing it, and he has placed his life in jeopardy because of it. We were incidentally due to fly to Nicaragua on the same airplane as he was, and we had considerable trepidation about it. Many people in Latin America have placed their lives in jeopardy, and many people have died within the church, priests, nuns, and bishops, for simply taking on the cause of the poor. And this man has done it. 75 years old, and I believe he has retired now this last spring. I want to jump over to my notes quickly with regard to what he had to say. We asked him the question, how did you happen to be converted to concern for social justice? His immediate response was, I am a Christian. Also, he said, I am a historian, and I believe he has a PhD in history, and can see God's judgment in history. And I can see that, number one, God is absolute. The church is not absolute. God is absolute. I was open to such a conversion. Now bear in mind that this church is very supportive, his church, very supportive of the poor. unlike most of the church presently in Mexico. The church in Mexico is quite conservative at this point, except for a few exceptions, and this is one of them. His statement, God is absolute, the church is not absolute. Also, my location in Morelos, the state of the revolution. Also, I remember my father, a lawyer, fighting for agricultural reform. I was raised in an area of a large hacienda. My father fought successfully for water rights for two farming communities. We asked the question of him, and I'll never forget it, why were you converted to concern for social justice? His immediate reply, I am a Christian. I'm going to stop there and ask if there are any questions or if there is any discussion at this point. We're coming close to 45 minutes. Yes?
I made a comment. I would love that the company that started the plant down in Puerto Rico for the advantages you're talking about, tax write-offs and so on, and there's a lot of good to it from that side too, and talking to the people that worked in the plant, we did a lot of training for them, and they ended up with, by design, the manager, everyone from the manager on down was Puerto Ricans, and these people were extremely happy to have jobs there. And that plan contributed a lot to the economy.
Now, that point is made frequently, and I think it's a valid point, by corporations doing business in those countries. I would offer this statement, however, and I'm not saying this about all multinationals. I think it can be said that any company that makes 75 to 80% return on an investment, no matter where it is, needs to question the morality of it. And I'm not suggesting that all of them are making that kind of return, but whether it be in Mexico or Cleveland or Chicago or Denver, that kind of return needs to be questioned on an ethical basis. But I think your point is a good one, that in some cases the multinationals have successfully done beneficial things there in the terms that you're talking about. I would hasten to add, however, that if one looks macroscopically at what has happened in Mexico, Mexico is an exceedingly rich country in terms of minerals and in terms of arable land. One of the reasons that Mexico now is in such dire straits economically is that it is tied in so strongly with the international trade game. It simply is locked into it. Its oil now is shipped to other countries, and it relies on other things coming in. If one could see that that Mexico had not jumped perhaps into such a strong capitalistic attempt to progress, it may have been in better shape than it is now. Mexico, if it were to rely somewhat on its internal resources, would be able to feed its people. And I think the plight of the poor, and I do not have statistics on this, I suggest to you that the plight of the poor in Mexico is considerably worse today than it was when this move started. I'm sorry I don't have the numbers, but I would venture to say that's the case.
This is not a question. Can you comment a little bit on the migrant labor problems in the United States and Mexico?
The question is, would I comment on the migrant labor situation from Mexico into the United States? I'm not particularly expert on that, but I think that it's clear that the situation in Mexico is so dire with regard to work and for the situation with regard to the rural areas that there is heavy press on Mexicans to come into the United States. And certainly the southwest portion of our country, the United States, as well as others, is experiencing a large influx of Latin American people. I have heard it said, and this is highly speculative, that there will be such a strong Latin population in some of our southwest states that in another 20 years there will be moves for Mexico to annex those portions back to Mexico because the political pressures will be so severe. I haven't the slightest idea whether there's any basis to that projection or not, but it is not unreasonable that would happen.
Just one comment about that. I live in Los Angeles, and it is now, all the formal statistics are that the Latin American is the predominant race in all of Southern California, including all counties.
Interesting.
Combining with the Asian and black populations, Caucasian population is very much a minority.
Interesting.
Yes. The big problem, as I see it, is that population growth. That woman had had two children instead of 11.
Yes. Yes, I think that point is an excellent.
We're all working on that end, but I don't see any hope for them. They say that, I don't know what the year is, but it's 2000 or before, that there'll be 30 million people in Mexico City. Well,
yes.
How can a city exist?
It is hard to believe. Just think about that. 30 million people in Mexico City. By when did you?
Well, I think it's 2000, by the year 2000.
I think that's accurate. Mexico City, I think, now has a population between 18 and 20 million people. And I think your point is well taken that the population growth in that country, which is significant, on top of just stable problems they're having, just aggravates the problem considerably. And going back to the cultural problem they would have, as I discussed the plight of the woman, we can see that problem is a tough one to resolve for them.
Also, the graft of the elected officials is horrendous. They bring so much money out of Mexico.
That's a good point, that the graft of politicians within Mexico is so high that a lot of the money either ends up in their hands or outside of the country. And one would have to, that's another point that I think needs to be made. Certainly what is happening with multinationals operating in such fertile ground economically has to be done with some complicity with those in government and those wealthy elite of the country, and certainly that is taking place. The oppression due to economic business of that sort is somewhat of a complicity between those elite and those foreign investors. It has to be that way, and there is considerable amount of that.
We're moving our big manufacturing plant to Mexico and other places, and they said labor wasn't the main deal, that they could buy the raw materials for about a third there for what they'd have to pay in the United States.
Interesting. Well, that's another factor that we haven't discussed, and that is that we touched on the labor element and also the other subsidies of transportation, et cetera, but also the drawing of the raw materials is another factor where multinationals tend to be subsidized. The amount we pay for the raw materials for those products there is similarly low. We're drawing not only on the labor pool but also on the capital pool or raw material pool of that country.
Is there a general sympathy to the other Latin American countries for the situation down there, not in Mexico?
The question is there sympathy to other Latin American countries from Mexico? Yes, the answer to that is that Mexico is quite sympathetic to some of the other countries that are in such turmoil in Central America. For example, Mexico has taken the lead in the Contadora group, which is the group of four countries, Latin American countries that are coming forth with proposals for negotiated settlements of the situation in Central America. Mexico is proposing very strongly to the United States that the United States change its position with regard to Central America. And so to answer your question, yes, Mexico is sympathetic to them.